When people think about democracy, we go right to the concrete actions, you know, get out the vote, gerrymandering, and we think of all those technical democracy type words. But I think an important part of our democracy is just having strong civic health. Are people involved in their communities? Do they have people that they can congregate with around shared activities in their community? We're talking about those things that bring you joy and show that you have a place in your community. I think at the end of the day, those things far outweigh all the bad things that are happening. We just don't talk about them enough, do we?
Hey, everyone, it's Hildy, and this is the Creating the Future podcast. I'm glad you've joined us here today. This is a place for us to explore what really creates social change. Beyond the assumption that change is slow and incremental, what creates the kind of dramatic, transformational change that we can see and feel? That is the question that drives this podcast. What will actually create the healthy, joyful future we all want to live in? I'm so excited to have Megan Cummings with us on the podcast today. Megan is Senior Vice President of Strategy and Impact at CF Leads, an organization that helps community foundations drive positive change in their communities. Megan's role at CF Leads is all about activating people to create equitable communities where everyone can participate and reach their full potential. Her background includes leading civic engagement at the Greater Cincinnati Foundation and over a decade leading Cincinnati's Women's Foundation, leading efforts for systemic change to ensure that women and their families have what they need to thrive. When I talk with Megan, I'm energized by how consistently she looks for what is strong to build upon in every situation. And so it is my joy to welcome Megan to the podcast today. Welcome, Megan, to the podcast. It is so wonderful to have you here. I've really been looking forward to this conversation. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this as well.
Oh, wonderful. Before we dive into the meat, could you talk to our listeners just a little bit about the journey that you've been on that led you to be passionate about social change and led you to where you are?
Yeah, it's so funny. When I reflected on this, if you think, when did this start and what do all the pieces look like that got me to where I am today? And I think there are a couple important through lines. I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I still live, and I just have great parents. And one worked for Delta. And so we had an amazing privilege to travel a lot. And with that came a lot of education about where we were going, checking out books from all these places and how the people live and what's the religion and all that stuff. So I just had this natural curiosity about the world and how people lived. And then my dad was a business owner, but was also in the Army for most of his career. And there was just this like hard work and discipline that I learned from him. And I think both of those were really big influences in my life to pursue something that had meaning and do it with a lot of grit. So I think my parents had a huge force in that. But I always remember growing up, even at the youngest ages, having something in me that when I witnessed an injustice, I just couldn't be silent about it. I remember this in so many different applications. You know, one, we had a school levy at my middle school. And a couple of friends and I came together and wrote this big paper about why this school levy needed to pass and what would happen if it didn't pass. I mean, Hildy, this wasn't an assignment. We just did this on our own like a bunch of nerds because there was just something that felt so important about fighting for what you care about. And so I've always had this streak in me to make sure I speak out and use my energy toward things that I feel are unjust or that think could be better in our community. So I remember that from a really young age, but I think that was paired with parents that encouraged that and modeled the way on that, and a few teachers along the way who just nurtured that and made me more curious and really set a path for what could, that you can do this in your life too, professionally.
What a gift that is.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. You're currently at a group called CF Leads. Can you talk a little bit about what is CF Leads?
Sure. So CF Leads stands for Community Foundations Leading Change. And it's a network, a national network of community foundations. And we partner with them to help do their community work better, whether they're doing research or policy and advocacy or helping cross sectors work together. Whatever community foundations are doing, we want to allow them and partner with them to do that at scale so they get the best possible results in their communities. There's over 900 community foundations in the U.S.
Wow.
And they span small to mega cities, rural, urban, suburban. Sometimes they're working on very specific issues. They're always working with generous people that want to make their communities better. And so we really just are huge fans of community foundations. So if we can partner with them to make their work more effective and so they can reach results at scale, that's what brings us joy. And that's why our organization exists.
That's wonderful. So many times we hear about community foundations and folks who are supporting them from the angle of money. And you guys really are looking at it from the angle of impact.
Of impact. That's right. And community foundations have been around for a long time, more than 100 years. The first one was in Cleveland, Ohio. And really proud of that because I'm an Ohioan. So this whole concept started right here in Ohio. And along the way, they've always provided great benefit to the community. But I think earlier on, they were much more traditional institutions that were more like a charitable bank. It was really a place for donors to put money that they then wanted to grant out in the community. And then the largest part of what community foundations do are make grants to nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And both of those things are incredibly important. But the secret sauce for CF Leads is really tapping into this heightened influence for community foundations that go beyond donors and DAFs and grant making. How can community foundations be this hub for social change? And so CF Leads really looks to these five practices that comprise community leadership. So we look at how do we center community voice and how do we work across sectors for the best solutions and how do we use data to inform our work? How do we marshal resources from the government and national foundations to amplify what we're able to do locally?
Sure.
And finally, policy and systems change. And we think these five levers just open up incredible power. And when we unleash all of those ways community foundations can work in their community, it far outweighs anything they can do with just their own grant making. So we get to work with people that are excited to do those five things every day. And hopefully, as they unleash that potential, we see really great results for their communities.
Wonderful to know that such an organization is out there. I'm really, really eager now to get into the question that I ask all of my guests.
Great.
Which you have led right into. I know that you have been in this work in a lot of different capacities throughout your career.
Yeah.
When you see change happening, the kind of transformational change that we all really want to see, what are the factors that you see undergirding that change?
Well, I think where I've seen an enormous change happen is when each person and each sector and each organization that's involved is playing to their strengths. Mm-hmm. So many of the things we were able to accomplish before I came to CF Leads, I was at Greater Cincinnati Foundation for 13 years. So I worked in our own community foundation here. And I think the most exciting projects we worked on there is when we brought not just the philanthropic community together, but the business community and government and what resources do each of those industries have to bring to an issue? I think a lot of times what happens is when we have a social problem or difficult, sticky problem we're working on in a community, it's often like, okay, philanthropy, you go solve that.
Right.
You're the problem solvers in that.
Right.
And yes, you know, that can be true. And we're a really important part of that problem solving. But why would we just limit our thinking to one sector to solve these problems that, quite frankly, we all had a hand in creating
right.
or continuing? So the business community brings great process and ingenuity and innovation. And people that lead our communities in the business, you know, let's put those talents that have made them successful in business into working on some of our toughest social issues too. And the government, you know, they have incredible resources. Whatever our grant-making budgets are, they are dwarfed by the resources that our government brings to bear. So how can we get government involved in both funding important solutions in our communities and making sure that our policies and practices that come out of the government and the laws that come out of the government are really putting us with our best foot forward so we can really imagine communities where everyone can participate, prosper, and reach their full potential. And I think there's this special sauce when we activate all of these people doing what they do best, that's where our best problem solving comes from. And philanthropy often has the ability to bring these people to a table to talk and get their best thinking on the table. So I think that's a really important part of it too. But that's certainly where I've seen transformational results, where everyone is working in their best skill set.
Can you share an example that you've seen of that?
Yeah, sure. So let's see. When I was at Greater Cincinnati Foundation, I was with the Women's Fund for a long time there, and we worked on women's economic self-sufficiency. And we did a lot of research around the issue of pay equity and pay gaps, et cetera. And one of the issues that kept coming up that is just a contributor, there is no silver bullet to these huge inequities. But there's a lot of things that go into them. And one idea that kept coming up was when someone's asked their pay history as they're applying for a new job, that often kind of tethers them back to, you know, what they've been making. It makes it very hard for them to go forward. So when companies put an application out for a job, they know what that range is going to be for that job. They know what's in their budget for that range. So right. Let's say they're planning to spend, let's say, $40,000 to $60,000 on a position they're putting out there. And they ask you what you're making in your current position. And you say, oh, I'm making $30,000. And they said, oh, we are so happy to offer you $35,000 for this position.
Right.
Because it's more than you're making now. But what our research showed at the Women's Fund is time and time again, especially women, especially people of color, and especially women of color, they have been underpaid throughout their career, and the research supports this. So when they put that number forward, they never get a chance to shed that historic pay inequity. Mm-hmm. And it's really important as we develop what jobs are paid, we're looking at what the market is demanding that job to be paid, what your education and qualifications should get you in the market. It has nothing to do with what you were making at your last job. It's really should be about what that job should be paying and what the market allows for that job. So we worked with our city council. We worked with the business community to say, what we know this would be a huge change for you. What would this look like if we implemented this change? And through a lot of hard work, a lot of negotiations, a lot of courageous leadership by city council too, we became the first city in the Midwest to put a salary history ban on applications for anyone applying for jobs in Cincinnati. And why that was so important, it was a direct concrete action that helped to minimize an inequity that we saw. We had so much data that talked about how this question very specifically was holding people back. We knew what the numbers were on that pay inequity in Cincinnati. We knew that it affected women and people of color most. Mm-hmm. But this is not a law that would hurt anyone else. This is a way that we were addressing a very specific part of our population, but it helps everyone that this law is passed. And there were some really difficult conversations we had throughout this time, but ultimately this resolution passed, this ordinance passed, and that question's no longer asked. And we think that will have generational effects, but there is no way just one person could have gotten this done. It came from data and conversations and bringing different sectors together, even the ones we didn't agree with, just to say, how would this affect you? Let me really seek to understand why you don't want this happening. And then we worked through those issues And at the end of the day, was everyone happy with this? No, but I think we did a really good job listening to and respecting those points of view and making changes in the language of the legislation that made it really common sense and addressed a lot of their fears without creating undue burdens on business. But that's how a lot of the problem solving has to get done. So that was a place where I was really happy that I think everyone came to the table with their point of view. And it was a really respectful place where we negotiate and thought, what's the best path forward to solve for this issue that is really holding folks back in our community from making what they deserve to be making in these roles.
You're making me think the very, very first question in the catalytic thinking framework is who will be affected by whatever considering, and what would it take for them to be part of this decision? Right. And we are so used to making decisions about other people and for other people without including those individuals.
Oh, that is so true. And two things I'll point out about this specific situation. One is on city council at that time, there was definitely the votes to probably get this passed in a form that was even more than we were looking for. There was probably the power to do that, but that wasn't the right way to do it. The right way was to sit down with everyone that was affected and really go back and forth to get the best possible bill. And even when you have the power to enact some kind of change, that's still not the right answer. Like, still bring people to the table, because there is unintended consequences to everything, even the most noble change we want. And I think part of being a great community leader, or, you know, if you're in an entity that works just problem solving, is really taking the time to understand what those unintended consequences are and solve for them before they happen. Legislation, community change, these are all really tricky things. We can't possibly understand what all the ramifications would be from any action we take, but the more people you listen to and problem solve with, that is just so important. And Hildy, I think a lot of times what happens is, you know, we do that for you without you. Mm-hmm. And that's not really helpful. We really need to be listening to the people that are most affected by any given situation. They often have the best answers.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the unintended consequences. We talk about that a lot, that these supposedly came out of nowhere where there's no way we could have known. And the answer is you could have known if you asked people.
That's right. It was interesting. When I was at the Women's Fund, we decided to move a lot of our grant making, actually all of our grant making as a fund, into the hands. Those decisions were made by people, women in our community that were struggling with the issues we worked on. And that was a big shift for us. But what we found is these women had so much wisdom, and they knew what was going on in their communities, and they knew what those issues were. And that was so important. I'll give you one example, if you don't mind. There was this organization that applied to the Women's Fund several years in a row for funding. And when we used to have kind of donors making these decisions on our grants, every year we heard the same feedback about this organization. The application was for a very specific neighborhood in Cincinnati, just to bring women together, like every Wednesday or Thursday night, just in community.
Right.
And when we had a group of mostly donors making that decision, they were like, well, how are we going to measure this? And how are we going to know they got these jobs? And what's their economic mobility going to be? And, you know, like all the different, we need to measure, it needs to be up and to the right, right? Like that's the measure of progress, up and to the right. And when we started bringing this advisory group together that at first was just advising our strategy for the Women's Fund, and then we decided to actually turn over our grant making to their decisions, they talked so much about needing social capital. They needed time to be with other women, often single moms, to get to know people in their community, to have women they could trust when they had to go to a job interview or a doctor's appointment that they could leave their kids with. They needed someone that, hey, you just got a job at this call center for a local bank. I've been trying to get a job there forever, and I've just never gotten through the thing. And now I know this woman, Teresa, and she can, you know, she can give me the thing. They just needed time to be together and create social capital. And here's a grant that we had overlooked for years because people said, oh, I don't know how we're going to measure this and what's that need. And the actual community, the women that were dealing with childcare issues and lower wage jobs and housing issues and the cliff effect, they were saying, what we need more than anything right now is connection to other people in the same situation that we can, you know, just network with and get to know. So the first year that grant came through and they were able to decide, that's a grant that scored very highly for them. They're like, this is exactly what we need. And so I think it's really important that we listen to the folks that are closest to the situation. And we all have blinders on. We have blinders on by the class we grow up in, whether we're middle class, upper class, you know, their family's kind of struggling from day to day. We all have blinders on. We have blinders on for our race and our gender and our ethnicity and religion. We all have blinders on. And sometimes I think a dominant narrative takes over and the dominant blinders take over that, well, this isn't having a positive effect unless it's up and to the right on all measures. And sometimes that's actually not what's needed for community progress and to see the kind of mobility that we hope for some of these communities. That was just like such a great lesson that we can't prescribe what people need in their lives. We need to be informed by research, but we ultimately need to be informed by listening to people and talking about what they need. And then how do we bring our resources to bear to some of that?
And it also helps us to align with the values that we post in our lobby. We post the old honesty, integrity, respect kind of things. But so many people now are adding inclusion into those words. They're not just words. What does inclusion look like in practice?
That's right.
Real inclusion.
Real inclusion, and where it's not just, hey, you were included to look at this plan we've already formulated.
Exactly.
That happens.
Yeah.
Or we're including you by telling you what we're going to do after the decisions have been made. Or we're including you, but still not giving you any agency,
right,
to make decisions. And I think agency and choice is so important when we talk about mobility in our communities. You know, we often talk about economic mobility. That's a real subject that we work on very, very deeply at CF Leads. But along with that is, you know, what choices do people have about their lives? And do they feel heard? Do they feel heard in society? We're just coming off of an election that, without getting into politics, I'm sure some people were thrilled about and some people were devastated about. And at the heart of it, having a few weeks to kind of reflect on where we are, I think there's a lot of unacknowledged pain in people's lives that is not being heard. And when people sense that frustration that they're not being heard and things are not going well in their life and no one is listening and making that change, then they're going to demand change in some way.
Yes.
And I think we've had many times in our history where when people just feel the unacknowledged pain, they don't have agency over their own lives. They don't feel like things are getting better. That's where we see more radical change happen. And we're at a moment where I think the lesson is that we really need to come together and listen to each other's pain, no matter which side of the aisle we're on, because there's something we're not understanding across that divide.
Listen to each other's pain and listen to each other's aspirations.
Yes, absolutely.
I love the fact that you started by talking about playing to everybody's strengths. Yeah. We are so used to asking about what's wrong, what's wrong, what's wrong. There is also some power in helping people to express what they aspire to, what they hope for.
That's right. Asking what is right with people's lives too, and building on that. We're working on some democracy initiatives right now that were on their way long before the election. It's not a response to anything. But when people think about democracy, a lot of times we're thinking, we go right to the concrete actions, you know, get out the vote and this and that, gerrymandering. And we think of all those technical democracy type words. But really, I think an important part of our democracy is just having strong civic health. Are people involved in their communities? Do they have people that they can congregate with around shared activities in their community? Just to your point, are they doing things that bring them joy with other people in their community? And so that is a real strengths-based way to approach that, is when we talk about strong civic health, which is absolutely essential for a strong democracy. We're talking about those things that bring you joy and show that you have a place in your community. Does my voice matter in my community? Do the things that I'm involved in positively involve other people that may or may not look like me in my community? So I think you bring up a great point that it's easy right now, especially in the news cycles, to just hear everything that's wrong with everything. And it's an onslaught. We just can't handle it as humans to hear how bad everything is all the time, all around the world. But I think it's really important what you're saying, like, how do we step back and acknowledge what is right and what is working and the connections and activities that we're involved in that do bring us a lot of joy and connection? Because I think they, at the end of the day, those things far outweigh all the bad things that are happening. We just don't talk about them enough, do we?
Oh my gosh, no. You're making me think about, you know, when we talk about connection and community, and we think about community as these big communities, mm-hmm. We went on vacation just recently, and my big disappointment is that every year our neighborhood, we're in a tiny little, very middle class, very working class neighborhood, and every year in the fall, our neighborhood gets together and does a neighborhood party.
Oh, fun.
And we close off a street and the kids do a jumping castle. And it is one of my favorite things. And all of our neighbors come together because it's all for the kids. So people that you wouldn't necessarily see that are on this side of the neighborhood versus this side of the neighborhood, they all come together. And I was so disappointed that we were going to be on holiday this year and we were going to miss that piece. That is neighbors connecting with each other.
Exactly.
And so when you talk about community connection, it doesn't have to be this huge initiative.
No,
it can just be people getting together.
And no matter what signs they had in their yard in November, it didn't matter, right? They come together and break bread together and have fun. And we have to preserve that. We have to find ways to nurture that. Because I think that it's so cliche to say more important than ever, but it kind of feels like it's really important to make sure we don't cut people off at this moment. We have to find ways to create those moments to be together.
I'm thinking back about your comments about the city council working with the business community and mm-hmm. people working together across different ways of thinking. And we've gotten to the point where we're almost afraid of each other.
Yeah,
we talk about connecting with people in community, and the first thought people have is, well, what if I'm connecting with those people that I don't agree with? And it comes down to that, even when we're sitting across from somebody who doesn't agree with us on an issue. So you're talking about the pay equity issues and mm-hmm. the salary history issues. It doesn't matter what the issues are. Sometimes we're just so afraid to sit down with the people who may not agree with us. What have you seen in terms of crossing those kinds of barriers?
Oh, yeah. So that's a really good question. Look, we're all guilty of this. We can have this discussion that's so civil and how we want the world to be. And I'm sure we're both guilty of thinking, oh, this is a difficult person. This this is coming. I know what they believe about this. And it's the exact opposite of what I believe. And that's really, really hard. Well, a few things. So personally, I would say, especially in politics, because that's on everyone's mind. If I know there is someone that I'm, you know, let's say on Facebook with, that I know we just are completely different channels, I don't really comment about those things. I don't know if that's a really productive place to be. I'm not going to convince them. They're not going to convince me. But I really look for places where I do have connections with that person. And, you know, maybe it's our kids are really good friends and I'll make a, you know, comment on something they post about their kid. And it's an authentic thing, but it's aside from all that political stuff. Or I had a friend that, again, we're politically couldn't be more different, but she just lost a parent. I just went through that last year. It was terrible. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. It's really, really tough. And I found so much connection and empathy to her because we shared that in a club that you don't want to be part of, losing a parent. And so I think when we have those other connections to people, it softens the other stuff. And so we can still authentically be connected to people as humans with a shared experience and completely disagree on something else. Personally, I just try to look for the places where we do have a connection and pour my energy into those shared connections and really back off from the stuff we're not going to agree on and probably never agree on. I would say professionally, as I mentioned, CF Leads, we work, there's 900 community foundations and they are in all parts of this country. And that's been something that's been really rewarding about being in this position is getting to visit so many different areas of the country and just learning what their communities are like and what festivals are important there and like what brings people together in those cities. This country is so diverse. The coasts are totally different than the Midwest and the Southeast. I mean, it's really, really diverse. And the through line for all of that is they're all trying to improve outcomes in their community. Every single person we meet with, they all get out of the bed in the morning and say, like, I'm going to put my energy toward making our community better today. So I think for us, there's a lot of different ways to come about that. There's conservative ways and more progressive ways to come toward those solutions. And I think our job is to really put forward what works. Like, how do we look at the research? How can we look at policy to support better outcomes in our community? So I think for us, it's like there's a lot of ways to come to great outcomes. And it really gets back to what you were talking about. How do we listen, appreciate people's strengths in it, understand what they're trying to move in their community, whether it's affordable housing or better third grade reading outcomes, and really understanding that there's a lot of different ways to get to great outcomes and how do we give them the tools so they can put those talents to task. And that's not to say there's there's a lot of discussion and tension around how that stuff gets done, but how do we give them the tools to work through that tension, especially right now? So I find that part to be like challenging and invigorating, that we can work with communities that look a lot different from each other. And when we bring together leaders from those community foundations that are in totally different necks of the woods, how much commonality they have with what's stressing them out and what they're working on. It's just amazing, the similarities. They far outweigh the differences.
It's so interesting when we make the assumption that everybody's going to be disagreeing versus we make the assumption that we're going to find what they have in common.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's a really powerful way to change your perspective. And there's a lot of things that are deficit-based. And when we just change that perspective that we're not going to approach it that way, it just opens up so many more opportunities. I learned from a facilitator long ago, they always pose these like, how might we questions when they're getting into a problem. How might we improve housing affordability in our community? How might we? And it just opens up this really optimistic way to look at a challenge.
Sure.
Saying that this is not a foregone conclusion that this is going to be a failure. How might we? Like, there are solutions out there. It's just, do we have the political and public will to pursue them?
You've also got me thinking in terms of the humanity of it. You were talking before so much about not just finding what people have in common, but that relating to someone who had just lost a parent and you had lost a parent. I'm thinking about the way we start our meetings at Creating the Future. We start our meetings at Creating the Future, our board meetings especially, are 2 hours long. And they're 2 hours long because initially they were an hour long and our board members said, that's not enough time. Can we have more?
Which
is the opposite of right?
What we usually hear. Yeah, of course.
So we went to an hour and a half and they said, can we have more, please? Which we're very
excited. You have a week long board meeting.
Exactly. You know, quite honestly, I think if we announced that, they would say, oh, thank goodness. It's because the discussions are so rich, but the reasons the discussions are able to be so rich, and that you really got me thinking about this when you were talking about Facebook and losing a parent, is that we start every meeting, our board meetings, our strategy meetings, by asking folks to just sort of bring them their whole self into the room mm-hmm. and to say, what's going on in your life that's been meaningful? Since we mm-hmm. last got together, what's been meaningful in your life? And after a while, you get beyond the very perfunctory and people are talking about, I'm really sorry if I'm not present. We've got a new baby and I haven't slept in 3 months.
And that is so honest, right?
You're able to actually be present with each other. And to me, there's just something so, we've lost that connection. You're talking about people who could be disagreeing on something as important as pay equity, to be able to bring their own stories into the room, to be able to bring their own selves into the room. There's something really powerful about that.
I think that's really important. And I think it's hard, though, when there's questions about, especially equity, about how people should get a fair shot in this world. That feels like a non-negotiable, right? And I think that's hard. That's something I struggle with. How can you not believe that? But it's often not that. You know, I think that's where we really have to get so much deeper. Sometimes it is that. But like the pay equity question, it wasn't that some people didn't think there should be pay equity or people shouldn't be treated fairly. They felt like employers had rights to ask that question and get as much information as possible. Because at the end of the quarter, they're reporting to shareholders or they're managing other budgets. So the core of it, I don't think it was this person doesn't deserve fairness. It was just a really heated conversation about what that fairness looked like. And not to say some people don't believe in any of these values. Of course, we know that's true. But I think that becomes really hard. Like, ooh, how much am I willing to really bridge that gap when it's like a human dignity and fairness and equity issue? That's hard. I still struggle with that. Like, how does that actually play out? That's a hard one. I don't know. That's something we can both wrestle with.
If these were easy questions, we would have fixed them a very, very long time ago.
We would have, right?
I really, really appreciate just your whole focus, really honoring people as people mm-hmm. and finding that connection, finding ways that folks have agency and choice in their own lives. If you had one thing that you would suggest to our listeners, that one practical thing that they can do to start making that shift, what is something you might suggest for folks?
Particularly around listening to others and helping people find that agency, or bigger
than
that? Pick one. Well, let's go with the agency thing. I think that's a good place to start. And maybe it's just supporting folks around you. I always think in like four different kind of levels of influence. First of all, we're in charge of our own reaction and our own actions to situations. So for whatever you care about in the world, what's that choice you can make with your own actions to support that, what you care about? And then we have this next level of influence, which is our peers and friends, like those that next place we are. And whatever that thing is that it's important to you, that change you want to see, how can you start talking about that change with the peers and friends that you care about and get them motivated around that? And then many of us work in organizations. And if you have agency in your organization, how can you make sure your organization is really tuned in to those values or the things you care about? And some folks are very fortunate and have the power and privilege to work in the systems area. And they can move governments. They can move big companies. They're maybe an elected official. I mean, they have influence at a much higher level. And then how can they work within that to make sure our laws, our policies, our practices, how our companies operate, can they incorporate that value? So I always thought that was really important. For me personally, I really deeply care about racial and gender equity. So I thought, what does that look like in my own life? How can I open up conversations to that? See where I have been wrong, see where I need to grow in that. How do I read the books and go to exhibits and listen to podcasts that really develop that part of me. There's always something to learn on that. But like, how do I do that own work on me to make me better? And then what does that look like in my peer and friend group? Who am I interacting with? How am I picking my providers, my doctor? And is that group diverse? How am I really intentionally being a parent and making sure my son who's coming up is understanding those values of inclusivity? How does that look at school? What books are we reading to him? Those are things I have influence over there. I happen to work at an organization that really cares about this stuff. Sure. That's all aligned. And so in our organization, how are we delivering that work? How are we making sure that content is infused in everything we do about equity? And then I was very fortunate that, you know, within the Community Foundation, we did play in those spaces with the systems level folks. Like, how do we change laws and how do we get companies to operate differently? And so when we have that privilege, how are we making sure we have the tools to help people change in ways that are meaningful at that level? So I would say every single one of your listener at least has one, two, probably three of those covered very easily. For whatever it is that we really genuinely care about, like how do we affect our own actions, our peers, our organization if we can, and then broader community if we can. And I think if everyone would put that to practice, it's amazing what could happen from that kind of action, that intentional action around your values.
Well, you have certainly given all of us something to think about and very direct actions we can take. We tend to forget how much power we have as individuals. And I'm so grateful to you for reminding us of the power that we have as individuals and as connected humans, which is where we are our best. Thank you so much for joining us today, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun to talk to you.
I'm so grateful to Megan for sharing her observations and experience with us. The examples she shared provide a range of ways to look at the strengths we all bring, and especially what that means for bringing people together to address community issues. I loved the story of the grant to the neighborhood where the women wanted space to just come together and build strength among themselves. That is where our power lies, in building trust networks, building on the strengths we already have. Megan reminds us of the power of listening, not just for what the problems are, but the strengths that people are sharing when they talk, strengths we may overlook as we're so busy diving into the problems. We focus so much on that at Creating the Future, listening for people's aspirations, their strengths, their values, rather than going down the rabbit hole of listening for what's not working. Megan's stories remind us of that power. Not just of listening in general, but truly in listening for the power people already have to build upon. You can learn more about Megan's work at the podcast page for this episode. And of course, if this episode got you thinking, we hope you'll share this podcast with your friends and colleagues and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, you can learn more about Creating the Future's work at creatingthefuture.org. Thank you for being with us today and for wanting to create a better future for our world. We'll see you next time here at Creating the Future.